Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars about books, research, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to have on the program today Gloria Curry. Gloria is an art historian, editor, and publisher. She's also a Vassar alumna. She's here to talk with us about her most recent book, When Giorgione Died, a Rebildungsroman in two volumes, published by Periscope Books in 2015. Hello, Gloria.
Hello, Tom.
Your book, When Giorgione Died, is an unusual book for certain. It defies easy classification, and I imagine your neologism, Rebildungsroman, in the subtitle, is a way of suggesting how it might be understood in terms of genre. Mm-hmm. It's an art historical monograph that addresses the art and life of the Renaissance artist Giorgione, darling of art historians as well as the art-loving public. Although there aren't many Giorgiones to be seen, and maybe those aren't Giorgione's, as we'll probably come to talk about. It's also a critique of the practice of art history as a discipline more widely. It's a critique of history and collective memory per se, one could even say. And also, I read it as a matter of genre, as autobiography. I remember I had the same trouble when I first read Freud's Interpretation of Dreams. I couldn't quite classify it as to what I was reading. But that book comes to mind as an overlooked example of that particular genre, autobiography. Once you understand it in those terms, the work reads a bit differently. So that's also the book where Freud demolishes the fledgling discipline of psychology as it had been practiced up to his time, something that you have in common here, possibly. So can you talk about the form of your book, When Giorgione Died?
First of all, thank you for comparing me to Freud. The mere mention of my book in something like the vicinity of the Interpretation of Dreams is, should we say, flattery or complimentary beyond anything I ever dreamed. Let me just explain Rebildungsroman, because I think that is also, it's sort of pertinent to the fact that I went to Vassar. Yeah. The Bildungsroman, which is a German term, refers to books that give an account of a young person's development. And it often involves his or her, mostly his, passage through university, through various kinds of mentor figures, various kinds of adventures, mishaps, till the person ostensibly achieves some kind of finished person, begins to achieve some kind of wisdom, and this often involves seeing through people that he had once admired and seen as mentors and seen as wise and learning that they're not so wise. And built refers to the idea of a picture, that you become a finished person, you're a person out in the world. And Rebildungs occurred to me because now that I'm a certain age, I thought, why can't one look back over one's education, one's life, and see it in the same way? Not that you're reminiscing, saying, oh, in the old days at Vassar, this is what we did in Art 105, 106, and you know, those kinds of things, as if it's all over and done and ashes in the fireplace, but see it as another development, that as you go back over certain key events or key people, key books in your life, that it can also be developmental.
Yes.
So that you're reforming yourself. You're not just looking back at your old self. You're creating a sort of new old self.
Yes.
So that was my idea for the book.
Yes, I'm a medievalist and specialize in medieval romance, and it's all about this often. It's about memory, and it's about about the protagonist in the romance coming to the end of the romance and then reformulating in some way everything that's happened to him or her so that some kind of wisdom ideally accrues.
You know, that's a brilliant connection because there are two or three books that have had a big impact on me and in the writing of this book. One of them is William Volman's Central Europe from 2005, in which there's a lot of medieval romance, you know, woven into it, sometimes referring back to Gottfried's Tristan, but a lot of it also how medieval romance was built into Wagner and how Wagner weaves its way into the German imagination under Hitler. So that idea was certainly there. And then there are other two books I should mention, just because if there are anybody's listening if they haven't read these books, they might give them a lot of ideas. Jeff Dyer's book on D.H. Lawrence and Binet's book, H.H.H.H. These three are all books that are hard to classify, I think. I think Bulman's book got the prize for fiction from the National Book Award. Binet's book, which is about the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich in Prague. It crosses between fiction and history. And then D.H. Lawrence, I mean, maybe that's the easiest because everybody knows D.H. Lawrence, is that Jeff Dyer started out to do a kind of biography of D.H. Lawrence, but instead of doing something which leads to master readings of Lady Chatterley's Lover or Women in Love, or even trying to use Lawrence's biography as a way of moving into his fiction, he really tries to, it's a sort of interactive book in which he, Jeff Dyer, narrates his search for D.H. Lawrence. And it's often smart, it's often funny, it goes back to Nottingham, and he recalls that D.H. Lawrence said this place should be bombed. It's such a miserable, dirty mining community. And of course, now it's a D.H. Lawrence shrine with a blue line that leads you through these streets to look at where he was born and where he went to school and all this kind of thing. So the book is sardonic and funny and smart, and it leads you into thinking about Lawrence rather than giving you any set notion. You know, here's what people have said before, and now here's my master reading placed on top of it. And I love that sense of it being dynamic and alive. And I think the same thing is true of Binet's book on Heydrich, because he talks about his fascination with Prague, with Czechoslovakia, his own fascination with Nazism. Why is he doing this? How could he write about an assassination when he would never himself have the courage to try to assassinate somebody, even if he thought he was the most evil dictator in the world? You know, and I really liked that, and I liked the way it was. I think interactive is too simple a word, but instead of thinking of history as something that's back there and you're just digging through archives, that it's almost as if you're in this ocean, and you're just treading water. You know, all you're trying to do is keep your head above water and allow all these currents to come to you and to keep afloat as you look at them and think about them. And something may pop up from the ocean floor that's 500 years old, or it may be something really recent. And so I like that idea that instead of swimming towards a goal, that you're in the midst of this kind of wave pattern. And that all of a sudden history becomes very exciting.
We ended our last show actually with a kind of motto for librarians, possibly, that the past isn't over, that history is a sort of mode of becoming, not just something that's over with, that's done. It does make for interesting history then, if you view it that way, the historiography.
Right, and also the sort of artificial distinction between history and fiction. Because I was thinking, you know, that Bulman is historical fiction, technically. I've looked up everything, and he's really accurate except for the romance that he imagined for Shostakovich. But the rest of it is really based on meticulous research into World War II in Germany and in Russia. So he's using his imagination. But historians should use their imagination. Anyway, that's where the book, the format, started, what you might call the sort of autobiographical element of it and the opening of it up.
So the form that the book takes, you have two volumes. It's a diptych in a way. And the first part is more historical, it seems to me, than clearly autobiographical. And that's where you look, as an art historian, at the figure of Giorgione and about Renaissance art generally. So can you talk about Giorgione and his life and work?
I can. I'd have to say that you're speaking to someone who has an opinion that many art historians would dispute, but I would dispute back to them, and the book was written from that point of view.
Those art historians have a lot at stake, right? So, you know.
They have a lot at stake. There's a lot at stake in museums, right? And there's a whole kind of web there. But Giorgione interested me because you would have to preface everything with, as if, that you have to take a lot on faith you know, and we can quote willing suspension of disbelief, but we're talking history, right? We're supposed to be talking history. And that everything I looked at, thought about in researching Giorgione, you could poke your fist through it. There's nothing solid, nothing substantial. And even the paintings that are usually attributed to him as the Castelfranco altar, which is in the town where he's supposedly from, Castelfranco. First of all, you can't even see it. I mean, it is so sealed in glass and, you know, under such protection in the cathedral of Castelfranco that you can't possibly examine it. But it's also heavily damaged. Everybody knows that. And that makes sense, after all. I mean, we're talking about works of art that might have been created, if they were created by Giorgione, 500 years ago. What lasts that long? And then there are a lot of fakes or maybe Giorgione's, and that interested me too, because it occurred to me that maybe they're real. You could say as if. Maybe they started out as being a painting, an early 16th century Venetian painting, but a lot of them looked like paintings that were wiped down or, quote, overcleaned. So what you got left is a kind of underpainting with shadows. And everybody said, well, what did Giorgione bring to Venetian painting? Shadows, sfumato. And you go, maybe, but maybe you could find that in Bellini just as easily. So I thought the whole thing was, if you want to believe in Giorgione, go ahead. But you're believing in something which is, shall we say, a very tenuous construction.
And the documentation we do have doesn't clarify things much, does it? We know very little about his life. And then the sales records of his works leave one wondering, don't they?
Yeah, well, there's also, I mean, if you go back, what are the central sources for Italian art history? Vasari wrote 1540, 1566. Which is the first edition of the Vasari Lives would have been 30 years after Giorgione's ostensible death. That's a long time. But also, if you compare the first edition to the second edition of Vasari's Lives, when he writes about Giorgione, they're utterly different. And are you going to say, well, the second one is corrected? Or is the second one as fictive as the first one, where he's just talking to people and it's memory, and people are saying, oh, yeah, him, he painted a lot of portraits or something like that. And Vasari dutifully writes this down. There are some documents, but they don't lead you. There's very little you can build on. Isabella d'Este wanted to buy a night scene. Well, the night scene's gone. There are night scenes done around 1510. Did he invent the genre? Who knows? I mean, it's just not there. The hardcore facts are just not there. So he exists as a kind of placeholder, I guess you would say. And you know, to pick up on your word from the beginning, a romance. It's a romance. He's a figure that it has to exist for some people to tell the story of Venetian painting.
Yeah, and the authors of this romance, to some extent, are well-known art historians of the 19th century, aren't they? Jakob Burckhardt and Walter Pater.
Well, particularly Pater. Particularly Pater, I think, and the essay, The School of Giorgione. And this opened up, should we say, a realm of fantasy, or you could call it a can of worms. Because he said, you know, that there was a slightly earlier book by two historians called Crowe and Cavicaselli, kind of early art historians. And they had done, in their book on North Italian painting, they had done a chapter on Giorgione. And they said, look, the so-called set of works that are attributed to Giorgione is total chaos. Most of them are copies of copies of copies of lost originals. Hardly any of them are authentic, So they cut Giorgione down to about three paintings or something like that. And Pater's famous essay, The School of Giorgione, says, well, who cares if he ever really existed? Because what we have is this kind of set of paintings that reflect his presence. Well, and also the idea, I think, of a myth or a legend, and that the myth is just as important as the real person, perhaps more important. It's better to be a myth than to have been a real person, because a myth is by definition romanticized and larger than life, and so on and so forth. So Pater's essay was brilliant in a way as pointing people to the realm of the imagination in history.
Where does The Tempest stand in all of this, which is a painting most people know by Giorgione?
It shows up this is the sort of thing I love. It shows up in Venice, ostensibly in the collection of somebody named Giovanelli. Now, what's important to know in this kind of games that get started playing or this kind of historical research, call it what you want, Tom. I will just put slash between those two, that there were some references. There's a catalog done of paintings in various kinds of private collections in Venice in the 16th century. And one of them mentioned a painting that belonged to someone named Gabriele Vendramin. And in this painting had a soldier and a gypsy and a storm. Okay. Painting had disappeared. Lo and behold, it shows up in the Giovanelli collection in the 1860s and 1870s. And who finds it? Morelli.
who has an
obsession with Giorgione.
And he's a shadowy figure himself, isn't he? I mean, we're talking about shadows here all through and through. And Morelli's very much like that himself, isn't he? I mean, we
absolutely. People take him absolutely dead seriously, and they shouldn't. I mean, first of all, the idea that he published his most important works under two pseudonyms. Now, what is he doing? I mean, that's game playing, if you ask me. I mean, why didn't he just publish the work under Giovanni Morelli, Italian patriot? He was a big patriot, but he became an art dealer, too. So anyway, when I looked at the painting, I've looked at the painting for a long time, and I've read a lot of, you know, interpretations of it. And then I thought, you know what? I think it's a fake. I think it's a fake for one central reason, is the greens that were used in Italian painting in the 16th century were very unstable, and they all turned brown.
Yeah.
And here's this painting with a lot of bright green, and it's also a painting that nobody can figure out. You know, that it's strange. And if you say, well, maybe it's a pastiche. It maybe it's one of Morelli's jokes, which he played many of. And one of the things he liked to do was play jokes on German scholars.
He was Italian, of course.
And he hated the Germans. He hated the Germans, first of all, for condescending to Italy and Italians. It's a very, very, very tense relationship. And so it occurred to me, I thought, you know, that's just the sort of thing Morelli would do, that he would plant this fake and set the German scholars spinning their wheels, and they would never figure it out. You
it's
know,
really
I mean, this man who publishes under the name of Ivan Lamelia, you know, and also don't get me going on it, but I've actually read Morelli, which I have to say is I think a lot of people who talk about Morelli have not read. Because if you read it, the whole thing, I mean, with his italics and his daggers and his asterisks and his heavy irony about fine German scholars who can walk into an Italian museum and not see a Giorgione when it's staring them in the face. Anyway, there you go. That's my take on him. So yeah, Morelli is, let's say he's, I think in my book I say something about him being from Bergamo in the Bergamasco. That's a famous figure in Commedia dell'arte. He's the trickster, the joker. And I think Morelli was very much that, and I think he enjoyed doing it. By the way, the Bergamo accent, if you speak with a Bergamo accent in Italy, most Italians will laugh at you. It's like speaking with a hillbilly accent in America. So, you know, he's got a lot of baggage that he's carrying. So he's a kind of shadowy figure. So The Tempest, in my view, is a fake, a 19th century fake. But most people regard it as authentic and the great enigma, the mystery, you know, that no one has ever solved. There must be probably well over 100 crazy interpretations of the painting.
So what about the institution we call the Renaissance and pay homage to that was handed to us by people like Pater and Jakob Burckhardt? I mean, what does this tell us about history and art history in particular as a discipline, as a scientific discipline?
I don't think it's scientific.
No.
I don't. I think that there's a lot of pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. And certainly, if you want to talk science, I would say that in things like digital photography, conservation techniques, all of those have greatly developed and become more refined in the last century. There's no two ways about that. I mean, because if you go back to a figure like Berenson, he was not even interested in technique, let alone problems of restoration. He had a kind of pseudo-scientific jargon that he would throw in about tactile food and life enhancement values and things like that. But it was very, very, very soft. So, no, I don't think our history is scientific at all. I think art history is a discipline that is very confused and has a lot of trouble coming to terms with its own system of knowledge and myth-making and service to various, should we say, class institutions and institutions of knowledge, universities, museums, so on and so forth.
So you're bringing, you know, your own critical tools to all of this, you know, interdisciplinary approach and modernist approach, one would say. The question then comes up, if this is the case with art history, what happened? I mean, why wasn't it subjected to the same kind of critique that all of 19th century culture was subjected to, you know, at least in other areas? You draw on Elizabeth Barrett Browning in the second volume of your book, and of course she didn't survive modernism at all. I've been working with Edna St. Vincent Millay lately, same thing there. That was a difficult cauldron for a Victorian to survive. And art history is a discipline that was built for the most part in the 19th century, but it just skated right through the whole sort of modernist period. We still read Burckhardt in Introduction to Art classes and Introduction to Civilization classes, even though we don't seem to have what you would call scholarly editions of his work. They're just the same translation.
Isn't it astounding?
Yeah, it is.
That there's
yeah.
not been a new translation of Burckhardt, a new annotated translation into English, which puts people in touch with all the changes in scholarship, there is a school of study of Burckhardt in Germany, though, of course, he was very anti-German, which sometimes is overlooked. He was a very conservative figure. Yeah. And that one thing I think that's modernism with, let's just say it starts with cubism for the sake of argument, that it put a kind of fresh face on a discipline that was extremely conservative.
Yes, yeah.
The founders were all people who hated industrialism. It hated Impressionism, and that the field was really founded on those kind of very conservative values. So that's one point to make. And for some reason, that's never even been acknowledged. I agree with you. And the other odd thing is that I was thinking about German scholarship. Mm-hmm. Germany was the most heavily policed society in Europe during the 19th century. And the universities were heavily policed. Censored because there had been a student uprising in the early 19th century, and the government really cracked down. And they continued to crack down, so that what you're drawing on is very conservative discipline, and a discipline in which some of the key players lived under very, should we say, restrictive censorship.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't talk about sex, couldn't talk about politics. Anything approaching left-wing politics would have gotten any of them into problems. I mean, forget being Jewish, you know, that started happening later, although anti-Semitism has a long history in Europe.
Yeah.
But anyway, so why did art history escape that? Well, what do you think?
It's striking when you think about it. Obviously, there's a lot of investment here. I mean, there's the authority of the system. Academics profit by the mythologizing of art and artists into an authority system, don't they?
Yes, yes. And I would say that that's also part of it, that art history was, should we say, a new field in the late 19th century, and its birth coincides with the development of museums and a new set of collectors. I mean, I think that that's something, one of the books I published, Annie Iguanais, book on museums, that the modern museum is built on the ruins of the French Revolution, and that it really came into being after the Napoleonic Wars, and there's a tremendous opening up of monasteries and churches and previous aristocratic collections. And all of this is flowing onto the market, and it's flowing into the collections of people, nouveau riche people of various sorts who are making money on industrialization and the reorganization of society, and they're founding museums. And art history is a discipline that grows up in this set of circumstances. So its birth, you know, is sort of authenticating this tremendous shift in artistic goods, right, out of the old aristocracy into the new aristocracy. And in its position is dependent upon a certain kind of myth about art and museums and the people that collect and buy it.
Yeah. And of course, the Renaissance sits as a kind of jewel at the center of this for all of the academy, really, doesn't it? Renaissance and Reformation.
And I think that one of the things about it is, I was thinking about this the other day, I was looking at some Berenson material. Mm-hmm. The flattery, I mean, Tom, the flattery of people who might buy a painting would make you sick to your stomach.
Yeah.
I mean, he is on bended knee, idolizing these people who have money. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is really cringeworthy. And he's telling them how great they are because they have money and they might buy a painting. And they are going to live forever in America, for example, because they have bought a great Renaissance painting.
Yeah.
You know, this is really kind of amazing, and it's also a turning point in American society because the idea that culture mm-hmm. depends on rich patrons.
Yes.
They are the nobility of American society. Forget the government putting up money. No, orchestras have to go around begging for money. You know, opera companies have to go around begging for money. They're constantly on a bended knee. I mean, you know, for example, when Annie Ignatz was working on her book was the most critical of the founders of museums in America that's ever been written. And she said it could be 10 times more critical, but she would get into so much trouble with the museum.
Uh-huh.
Because anybody who gives a painting to a museum is a benefactor, right? He's wonderful. The painting is wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, the Met has some paintings hanging in that were given to them that should have been removed years ago. But that because they were given by an Altman or something like that on the terms that it would remain forever in the Metropolitan Museum. There it is. So I think you're right that there is this, what do you call it, cooperation, collusion, but that art history was in the service of people who wanted a certain kind of narrative. You know, and they wanted museums to be backed up. They wanted their roles defended. And the Renaissance plays into it because the Renaissance was seen rightly or wrongly, I would say largely wrongly, as a period of great self-invention when the elite of Italy ripped themselves away from the aristocratic model of the Middle Ages. And there's this new class of people, the merchants, the bankers, who reinvent themselves and they reinvent culture. And it's a culture of brave, wonderful individuals. And so the moneyed people in America, they love that, right? That you can be nobody and you can create a culture around yourself from nothing. That they're these wonderful individuals. And never mind that, you know, that whole category of individual can be crushed in both in America of the 21st century, the 20th century, the 19th century, but also Italy. So I think that's part of it. I think this kind of way that the Renaissance, as it was interpreted, fit into an atmosphere, a problem, a dilemma, a turning point in American society. And I think that's where Henry James becomes really important, I think.
Yeah.
It's part of the European-American narrative, the grand narrative.
Well, you draw on, in When Giorgione Died, literary works to a great extent, Henry James's novels being, you know, a case in point. And I wonder, is that because literary works sometimes are a lot more clear-sighted about the past than historical narrative? And a case in point would be differences in literary and art historical treatments of the pastoral, beginning, well, you draw on Virgil himself, but also Shakespeare, Italian comedy, whereas, you know, the art historical promotion of a certain idea of the pastoral is not what you find in these literary works at all. It's not self-critical at all. And not
no, it's not. It's almost laughable. I mean, it is laughable. It's farcical. It's farcical. I'd have to say it's really farcical, especially since it's so easy to go to a library, right, and ask someone like you, what's the latest on pastoral? And you know, and get a whole lot of books and sit down and read about it. But they don't. Okay, let me tell you, let's back up on the literature thing.
Okay.
I went to the same high school as Martha Nussbaum. And she, as you know, brings literature into the study of philosophy.
Yeah. Does she ever?
Because literature often defines, for example, ethical problems in a way that is very accessible, very subtle, creates a ground for common discussion, removes it from the arena of high specialization. And I went to the same school, and it had, at the time, it had what was regarded as the best English department in the country.
Oh,
yeah, and when I got to Vassar, I was really disappointed because, but anyway, so that has always been part of my education, and I could never understand why there were these boundaries drawn because, you know, my education up till the point I got to Vassar was you were just moving across it. I did a lot of French. We did a lot of French literature, English literature, history. It was all sort of crossed together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that Martha Nussbaum example loomed large in me, because I thought, that's really important, and there's no reason why it can't be done that way.
That's so interesting, because I asked her the exact same question I asked you, and when I was formulating it for you, I was thinking, who did I just ask this question to? Oh, it was Martha Nussbaum.
Did you interview her?
Yeah, I did, about a month or so ago, and she talks at length about literature, and that really struck me about her latest book, actually. Her close reading of literary works, because I'm a literature person myself, and I get excited when I see a strong reading, you know, of a classic, and she's really just wonderful. And you, too, here. I mean, I have to say, you know, you're reading a Virgil. I don't know, you know, if it was your own reading. And Virgil on the Pastoral, it's something I had never considered. I just looked upon Virgil as a sort of source for the idea of the Pastoral and never really thought of him critiquing the whole idea of the countryside very much in the way Ovid would, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In the book, actually, the two parts of my book are based on Pastoral. There is nothing, I mean, only someone who really knows Theocritus and Virgil could crisscross it all, but everything that happens that I do in the book is based on Pastoral. Mm-hmm. It's based on Virgil and Theocritus. One of the things that struck me about it is there is an idea of memory, and that it's not what you can write, but what you can sing, what you can say, what you can perform, how you live. And then that between that is there's this kind of very subtle interplay between making something up and living it, if you follow me. I mean, you know, so it's not just a question of illusion. It's about something. If you say something, does it come true? And so there are these wonderful permutations in both Theocritus and Virgil of something between casting spells, you know, witchcraft, through saying various things, to epic poetry. You know, that if you write the Aeneid, does Aeneas become this great hero? And so that there's this kind of sense of the various, I don't know, levels is the wrong word, but let's just say that writing as an instrument with all these different notes that you can play, you know, and you fill the air with them, and the idea, and I love the idea, and I think this is something that I'm sure Theocritus and Virgil both thought about, which is once you make a sound, it never disappears. It keeps vibrating, vibrating, vibrating in the cosmos. And so the sense that Theocritus did these poems in Greek, you know, in hexameters, and they vibrate on. And Virgil's very alive to this, that he picks it up. He hears the vibrations and you know, kind of improvises off them. And so it goes. And I love that idea. And so the book is, in part, this kind of response, you know, call and response, call and response. And the two, you know, seeing double, looking twice, you know, going back and forth, back and forth. And that it's in the going back and forth that the vibrations get richer and develop and turn into a, you know, a duet, into a quartet, whatever. So that was where I went with Pastoral. I don't know. I think I've strayed from your question.
Well, no, it leads into the next question about literature, that in literary studies, if not literary history, there's an acknowledgement that authors are, to some extent, necessarily sort of necromancers and shadowy figures in themselves. In part because we're aware they're so good at creating fictions about their persona, you know, often operating on multiple levels within a text and even outside of a text, that we understand that the imagination is about phantasmata, and, you know, the work creates the artist, the poet, the writer, as well as the writer creating the work, in a sense. And there's an understanding of that sort of as implicit with all literature. So reading literature, you know, as you mentioned, as we started out, it requires, following Keats, a certain suspension of disbelief. You know you're dealing with shadows, in a sense, with literature. So the question is, should works of art and the artists also, who are creations of these works, be any different? Should we read them as characters in a fiction of a kind? And I'm thinking, you know, here the artists that jump out, apart from Giorgione, if he ever existed, or Rembrandt, of course, dealing with shadows, Caravaggio, Leonardo, and then, you know, literary people like Marlowe, Poe, Hugo, you know, are very much about this kind of shadow world.
Well, 2 points. Okay, one is to go back to the literature that I think particularly with undergraduate education, let me speak now as a former student at Vassar and somebody who occasionally taught at university, that it seems to me it is a big mistake to think that you're doing an undergraduate a favor by assigning them, say, an article in the Art Bulletin and teaching them a kind of highly technical, very narrow approach to art history. And when I was teaching, I used to teach Raphael through Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky. And the undergraduates love it. They want to read Dostoevsky. Yeah. That's much more interesting than, because it's much more interesting to think about why did Dostoevsky have an obsession with Raphael, and particularly the Sistine Madonna, than to read a really rather turgid, badly written article on, you know, a minor motif in Raphael. Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole kind of questions just open up. So I think literature should be woven into, you might say, the study of the humanities and moving back and forth much more freely. Back to the shadow world, I think one of the reasons I staged the book as a kind of lecture, you know, where Teach can't stop lecturing and showing slides.
Amanuensis
is saying, stop it, I can't stand it, turn on the lights.
Yes. I
mean,
I was thinking Taylor 102 in the, you know, the lecture hall here while I was reading it. It's almost set in that space, the book. So.
Well, now, and I did do an essay. I did a paper up the Clark Art Institute, and then they published it in, you know, one of their collections of essays or papers given at the Clark, which I began in Taylor Hall during a 105 lecture. Mm-hmm. And it was me as an undergraduate sitting there, not knowing, should I write down everything the person's saying? Should I look at the painting? Can I see the painting? What is that person saying? I don't understand a word he or she is saying because it's got all these long French and Italian words or Latin words or whatever. But anyway, it went on from that. I mean, because there was also the idea about being a sleepwalker and things like that. But I have to say, one of the things that art history and art historians have not been good at doing in terms of reflecting upon the way they pursue and present knowledge is to address the vast difference between the way they pursue knowledge and present knowledge. Because they pursue knowledge by going to archives, for example, right?
Yes.
Looking at documents, reading letters, looking through old exhibition catalogs. But what do? They put on a shadow play.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you turn off the lights, there are sometimes little reading lights, or now the students sometimes use laptops or whatever. It's a drama. It's a shadow play. That you become this figure up at a podium, your voice is magnified, you've got a laser pointer which mysteriously has a little red arrow that goes around. You can make images appear from ancient Egypt, Africa, Tanzania, Australia, Germany, Russia. I mean, you are a wizard up there, right? And what's mesmerizing is the show itself, the juxtapositions that you make, the whole atmosphere that's like a church service or a kabuki play or a shadow play, all of this kind of thing, and a lot of the, what you might call the authority, the romance, the fascination of art history is there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not in the publications. Yeah. It's there in the lecture room. Art history is not only, should we say, consubstantial with the great opening up of the aristocratic system and the pouring out into new hands of art treasures from many centuries.
Yeah.
But it's also consubstantial with development of photography, the camera, and the slide of various kinds, starting out with the big lantern slides and then moving on to digital presentations now. But without that, art history, if it existed, it would be a very minor field like numismatics or something. Mm.
I should say we're recording this on Halloween to play, you know, at a future date, so it sort of suits, you know. There's something about a person lecturing there. They're usually lit from the lamp that illuminates what they're reading from, so they're illuminated from below in this dark space, and the lamp shines up on their chin, and if you try to see the face of the person lecturing, it looks very ghostly always, and of course, you know, there are these great images moving behind. Sometimes the images are pasted right on the lecturer, depending on how you've got the...
One of the turning points for me in my, shall we say, rather distanced critical understanding and practice of art history is the first year I ever taught, it was the first time I'd ever really given a lecture. I was supposed to lecture on Michelangelo in the survey course. And I had this little lecture ready, which I had done what I thought my homework was, you know, looking at the standard books on Michelangelo. And I was standing at the front of the room in the dark, right? And I pushed the button for the first image, and on comes the Michelangelo St. Peter's Pietà something like 25 feet high.
Yeah.
Right? I'm standing there in front of it, and I see my shadow on it.
Uh-huh.
I went, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I realized that everything I was going to say was beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because here is this astounding work of art. And what I had to say was, I mean, irrelevant. And then I remember standing there and watching how it seemed to fall apart. You know, the way the drapery kind of glistens and fold after
yeah.
fold after fold after fold, and the body of Christ seems to be slipping off her lap. And I thought this work of art is sort of poised between being a kind of structure and just collapsing into these waves of marble. And what did you say about that? And I got into trouble because I stopped talking. I mean, I blew the lecture. They had to remove me because I was just stunned into silence by what I saw and also the vast gulf. I mean, talk about cognitive dissonance between the silly things I was going to say about Michelangelo was born here, there, and everything, and this work of art, which completely should and certainly did, I think, blow me away. And also, I think there's this to be said about art history, and I was trying to get at that with the slide lecture business, both in this book and then in the essay, which I'll send you a copy. It's The Case of the Errant Art Historian, which is the essay, the paper I did up at the Clark, is the idea that, what are you talking about? I mean, when you put something like, to say, the Michelangelo, St. Peter's Pietà on the screen, it's huge, it's dramatic, it's semi-translucent because of the light system that's being used, whether you're using a laptop or whether you're doing it in the old-fashioned way, which is what I mostly did, which was slides being projected, you know, with light coming directly through the slide, because that's what the students are seeing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about photographs in a book? Because that's also what students will see and what you see. Are you talking about a work of art that really cannot be seen? Because when you go to St. Peter's, it's behind bulletproof glass and very removed. I mean, you can stand there with opera glasses and try to bring it into view, but there is no way you can get close to it. It's something, it's a kind of image.
Yeah.
It's not a work of sculpture even. It's an image behind bulletproof glass. So what you're talking about is a lost original, even if it still exists, if the Michelangelo literally still does exist, and I believe it does, in St. Peter's, it's a lost
original.
It's
a lost original. That's an interesting way to consider it because, you know, the imagery is, especially now, it's so monumental with these huge digital images we have. And I remember the first time I saw one fully projected when we got a new projector here was Church's Niagara. And it took up the whole screen in Taylor 102. So it was, you know, 50 feet across and about 25 or 30 feet high. And,
and the painting's what, 2 by 3 feet?
Yeah, it's not very big. And, you know, Mona Lisa, the same thing, 25 feet high, you know. It's wonderful.
And that's
you can
another
see
one.
The
it's
detail.
A lost original.
Yes, yeah,
you
it's
can't
lost
see it.
Not through the tourists.
No, and I think that's really, really interesting and important. And may I mention a book that I've just finished writing this section about, about sort of great novels that people should read in art history. It's George Eliot's Romola. She, by the way, dislikes the Pater Renaissance book. She thought it was amoral. But it's set, it's a great novel, it's set in the Florence of Savonarola. And it plays off Romola, who's a young woman who's sort of in semi-servitude to her father, who wants to be a scholar. You know, he's got a collection, he's got ancient statues. So he's a kind of figure of the Florentine patriarch. And then there's a Greek that comes into it, and they fall in love, da-da-da-da. But anyway, it's a brilliant book about a collision of culture and belief systems in Florence in the era of Savonarola. And it's also a brilliant book about what you see and don't see in Florence. And how Florence, one of the reasons people get so mesmerized by it is you're walking through what seems like an outdoor museum, right?
Yes,
you look around, you can touch buildings, you can lean up against them, you can take selfies, you can walk in and out of them.
Yes,
never mind that the buildings have greatly changed.
Yeah, no.
But then what she picks up on is the works of art are visible, and then the ones that are invisible, that you cannot see, the lost original. And there are two, both of them are cult images. The Annunciation, I don't know if you've ever gone into Santissima Annunziata, the Church of the Annunciation in Florence. The back part of it was sort of redone by Alberti, but in the front, on the left wall as you come in, is a supposedly miracle-working painting of the Annunciation. And it is covered with votive offering. Brides bring their bouquets there. You know, it is candles, wax offerings, bridal bouquets. And George Eliot picks up on this, the idea that the living work of art, if you want to call it that, is invisible. You can't see it. You know, it's a lost original. It's always lost. And is that the condition for faith, belief, for miracles? Whatever, but it's an absolutely brilliant scene. And then she builds it out into a night scene when it's the feast day of the Annunciation. And the piazza in front of the church is filled with people holding candles, and it's all mixed up. It's people hawking things, people selling false miracles, so on and so forth. And this becomes a kind of popular culture. And that popular culture has this lost original at the middle of it. And I thought, wow, is that interesting, right? I mean, at least it is to me. And why don't our historians talk about things like that instead of moving through the litany, you know, whatever. So there you go. But anyway, so I think that's really interesting. Most of the time, art historians are talking about lost originals, things that can't be seen.
So anyway, I wanted to get on to your second volume a bit more. Specifically, I didn't read it as a corrective to Seeing Double. Thinking Twice is the name of the second volume. But it's maybe an attempt to deal with the implications of false cultural memory, which is what the first volume was about, with the implications of that and, you know, your own career as an art historian. So it works as a kind of literary philosophical dialogue for me, where you have two figures in conversation, the narrator called Amanuensis and Aurora or Teach. And I wonder if you could talk about the drama here, the psychological drama, as these figures talk about their experiences of works of art and literary works, and also places like Gettysburg.
Did you notice that in the back of the book that there are two authors' photographs? Well, one is the supposed self-portrait by Giorgione, and then there's one, a photograph of me in which I am posing, as you know, that Degas portrait of the woman. It's in the Met, and she's got a big bouquet of flowers next to her, and the flowers supplant her.
Yes.
Well, I had a photograph taken like that of me, where I'm posing. I'm reenacting the Degas portrait with a big bouquet of flowers, and I'm wearing a leopard skin pillbox hat as an homage to Bob Dylan.
Yeah,
okay. And then what I did was I switched the bios. So my bio, my brief bio, is about Giorgione, so that there is a kind of sense that I am as fictive and as elusive as Giorgione, right? We all are. That Giorgione, in that sense, the shadow figure, is us all. We're all shadowy figures, you know, we're all elusive little glimpses of this, that, and the other kind of thing.
Yeah, I admit it.
I'm completely insubstantial, you know, and I love mirrors, and I love the idea of this, you know, the self as this concoction of splintered images seen in broken mirrors. So there was that idea. So there's that from the, so that the Giorgione figure is me, sort of in some ways going forward. And I like the idea of splitting it up to have two characters, first because I thought it would be funny. And I love the idea, you know, of the various kind of duo characters that appear, you know, buddy movies, escape movies. And then one of my favorite operas is Don Giovanni, where Leporello begins by saying, I don't want to be a servant anymore. I don't want to keep writing lists of Don Giovanni's various conquests, militare, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I like the idea of a rebellious buddy who would be a scribe like Leporello, but also saying, I don't want to do this anymore. You're ridiculous. And so I thought that the tension that becomes a kind of, and again, this goes back to pastoral, whether there can be mirror plays between two shepherds in pastoral. So it's a, like that. It's a kind of mirror game where he sees me, I see him. He doesn't see what I think I am. I don't see what he is. Back and forth, we have dialogues where he argues with me and makes fun of me. And so all of that. And I thought it was a way of developing the idea that a character does not exist isolated in a shell, in a sort of single portrait. but that the person exists in these kinds of dialogues, these arguments, or even in the spaces in between, the implications, the silences, what's not said. And that's why I also have a lot of turning on and off of lights. It refers, you know, to the slide lecture or the art history lecture, but also the idea that, you know, what's that great line in Proust? That we're all deep sea divers underwater groping a quarter of an inch by a quarter of an inch, and we think we see somebody over there. Oh, maybe that's your boyfriend. Oh, really? You know that. So I like that idea of darkness and swimming and being submerged and, you know, groping towards somebody else and misunderstanding one another. So that's how that got going.
A lot of this second book here, has to do with American history and art. And two themes especially come across here. I'm thinking, you know, it is Halloween. I'm thinking Edgar Allan Poe again here. But, you know, death and necrophilia become a theme in this book when we start dealing with Americans immediately. I don't know if you say the same with the Italians or the Venetians, but certainly with Americans it's the case. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
As somebody who was a Europhile, you know, and spent a lot of time in Europe in various places, and lived in Morocco and places like that too, but the idea that, and also being a kind of figure out of Henry James, that's why I think Henry James is so important for people to read, you know, undergraduates particularly, to get an angle on that relationship, the American-European relationship, both as you live it out individually and how it's lived out. It's still being played on, you know. I mean, it's just absolutely fundamental to American identity. And so one of the things I thought in the book was turning back to America. Why am I involved with this Italian culture, which even if I lived there for years, I still would not be a native. I would still not understand it completely. So that was part of it. And I thought, go back to America as this kind of thing of the rebuilding, you know, that I had a very Europeanized education, right? Studied lots of European history, read lots of European literature. And I thought, why not go back and go through the American experience, you know, as part of the rebuilding. Who are you? How does that play on to your identity now? So that was where the American came in.
Venice is a place that once loomed large in American identity formation, and it appears and reappears in your book here. We talked about James. And also the Italian futurists regarded it as a victim of a kind of European and American colonizers of the past. Today, it's overrun with tourists to the tune of 30 million a year and in danger of being swamped by the gargantuan cruise ships that the government allows to plow through the lagoon to dock there over vociferous complaints. So can you talk about Venice a bit?
Yes. But can I warn you, Tom?
Yes.
I used to teach a whole course on Venice.
Oh, that's okay.
And so what I used to do with this course, which I think we all had a really good time together and we really learned a lot, I would summarize Venetian history and art history pretty quickly in two or three lectures. Then we would dig in, starting with Romantics with Byron and with Napoleonic conquest of Venice, with a, you know, and there the end of the Serenissima, the Republic, and beginning of this other history where it is the dying patient, it is consumed, it is this, it is that, and it becomes a great literary site. And I think more than any other city in Italy, and I say this, I will say it, even more than Rome, writers have come to Venice and written great, whether you talk about Rilke or Proust or Thomas Mann. I mean, it just keeps going, James Merrill. And movies and operas, because, you know, after all, Wagner wrote Tristan and Isolde in Venice. He died in Venice. So it is this site where all this culture happens, and it's all elegiac, it's all necrophiliac in a way, because everybody knows Venice is going to go down into the sea.
The
Nunzio is another great writer on Venice, Il Fuoco, and Il Fuoco was huge success when it first came out. And that's also about Venice being a dead city, and can it be brought back to life? You know, and this is the great question for the futurists. Can Venice be brought back to life? Does it have any place in the contemporary world? Or should we euthanize it and put it to rest? And so Venice, first of all, it's beautiful, right? It's still beautiful. Best preserved medieval Renaissance complex of buildings infrastructure in Italy, more than Florence, more than Siena, more than Rome. It is also this strange, wonderful place of water and canals and, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of thing. And, you know, and it's got rich colors, so it's kind of fairy tale world. Although I think it's also a place. It's sinister. It's deadly. It's got deadly cholera, you know, for example, in Death in Venice for Thomas Mann. So I don't know if I'm making any sense, but it brings together issues of life and death on an individual basis, you know, Millie Field dying in Wings of the Dove, Aschenbach dying in Thomas Mann's novel, and then the great opera based on it, and the great movie. And then ideas of culture and civilization. When does a culture die? When is it reborn? How does it die? How does it reborn? So that's a kind of issue that is discussed on and on and on in, you might say, the study of heritage sites. Should Venice be preserved as a heritage site? They have something like less than 35,000 full-time inhabitants now.
35,000 inhabitants and 30 million tourists.
I have friends who, you know, who came from it. Their families move away. They can't stand it. Because it's also that I can trace it every year I've ever been there. Fewer and fewer markets where you can actually buy food to take home and cook, for example. Places where you can go and have a coffee without being swamped by tourists coming in. So that it has become a kind of what you might call a tourist spectacle, which profits some people, but is this a living city? What are you seeing? Or should you might as well go to Bellagio in Las Vegas, some people would say. So Venice is endlessly fascinating, you know, from all these points of view. And, you know, I'm drawn into it from the point of view of music, of the visual arts, of literature, but also from the point of view of this issue of what is a living city? And that's something that here in America, I mean, you know, the endless attempts to make New Haven a living city again. So Venice has all those kinds of things. And the other thing about Venice, of course, is it's east and it's west. You know, it's a kind of, some people would say, an inferior version of Istanbul, of Constantinople. So there's that. And then I think you mentioned once when we were talking about how much of the realities of the Venetian Empire have been negated in this.
Yes, and yeah, the history, particularly. I mean, it's a history based on slavery, yes,
absolutely.
Time, you know, and art history has a way, when we look at these places, of obscuring the, you know, our knowledge of the history, doesn't it? We look at the artists and celebrate them, but we don't look behind the arts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The number of slaves being brought in from Eastern Europe, and then after the Turks moved so far west that they couldn't bring the Caucasian slaves in, which was what they preferred, they started going to Africa and bringing African slaves in. And that the Venetians did exactly what American slaveholders were going to do. They sent the men to do field work, largely. And, you know, and there are huge, for example, sugar plantations in Crete.
Yes, the whole island of Crete, wasn't it, basically, was a
plantation.
Plantation for Venice, yes.
And they liked the women to work in the households and also as concubines. Yeah. You know, that was standard. You know, I brought it up, I think that the Renaissance book, which I think you also have a copy of, in the back that we have pages about slavery with sort of non-photographs, empty frames for the slaves with statistics underneath, because they were found throughout Italy. And that if you want to go back to the myth of the Renaissance, the fact that the historians who were creating what we call the Renaissance in the 19th century overlooked the fact of slavery, and it's still being overlooked. It was a slave society. That's there. So, yeah, Venice with that. The empire, I was looking through some things on villa culture. The number of villa owners who were killed by the peasants was astounding because they hated them, of course. They were absentee landlords, and they were really, really exploited. And so what you might call the brutal side of Venice, and then the rest of the so-called Great Renaissance cities has been obscured. And I don't know what it would do to the sort of tourist industry or the rewriting, which should be done, of the history of the so-called Renaissance, should be done from that point of view.
So I'd like to thank you, Gloria, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, When Giorgione Died, a Rebildungsroman in 2 volumes, published by Periscope.
Thank you for having me on the show, Tom. I enjoyed our conversation a great deal.
Yeah, me too, very
thank
much.
You.